Your voice on America's News Talk, The Pledge, with Gene Parker and Nancy DeBoer. Your opinion and your voice matters. Call now and share your voice. 931-1276. That's 931-1276. Uplifting, inspiring conversation about faith, your community, and you. Your voice, the heart and soul of the Lakeshore. On America's News Talk, The Pledge.
America's News Talk is The Pledge. Gene Parker and Nancy DeBoer. February, of course, is Heart Health Month, and we have Dr. Bill Frauenheim, a cardiologist at Holland Hospital, on the line. Hi, Dr. Bill. How are you this morning?
I'm doing great, guys. Thanks for having me on.
So it's so cold outside, and we're thinking warm thoughts about keeping our hearts healthy. How can we do that?
Well, when we're talking about heart health, generally we really want to stress lifestyle, because a good healthy lifestyle can prevent 80% of cardiovascular disease or heart attacks. And so a healthy lifestyle, you know, I like to try and keep it simple. There's really three key things to remember. One is, do not smoke. A second is, be physically active. And in general, the goal for most people is 30 minutes of activity 5 days a week. And you can break that up into small chunks, as little as 10 minutes at a time. And the third thing is to eat right. And, you know, eating right in this day and age means a plant-based diet. That's lots of fruits, vegetables, whole grains, and then staying away from things that could get you into trouble, like a lot of red meat, high-fat dairy, and sugar-sweetened beverages, things like pop, juice, and artificial sweeteners.
Does it matter how long or how intense that exercise is?
Well, you know, that is a great question, because our thought on that has actually changed over time. To get health benefits, we're really just talking about moderate activity. So moderate is, it doesn't mean you have to be doing a whole lot. You know, this is just a casual walk, get your heart rate up a little bit, but you can still carry on a conversation while you do it. So the cardiac benefits start at a very low level of exercise. Now, if you increase your activity and it becomes longer and more intense, then benefits do increase as the intensity of exercise increases. We used to say there was kind of no limit to that, but in the last couple years, you were starting to recognize, in this era of like extreme ultra endurance athletes, 100-mile races, you know, there does seem to be a limit. And once you reach, for example, 35 miles of jogging or running a week, which most of us will never get close to.
Yeah, really?
Yeah, but once you go over something like that, then you might start to lose some of the benefits.
Wow. Yeah, I had always thought you had to have like 30 to 40 minutes of like fast enough walking, at least, that you're, you know, you can feel your heart rate going up, brisk walking, in order for it to do any good at all. So that's kind of encouraging.
Right, it is encouraging, because, you know, most people, a lot of people can't do that.
Yeah.
So we've really kind of backed off on that. I think that was our message originally. And now we realize you just don't have to be that, exercise does not have to be that strenuous. And even just what we call activities of daily living. You know, that's like walking, you know, into the store, gardening, going up and down your basement stairs to do laundry. Even activities of daily living will give you health benefits. So we're really trying to just be as active as we can during the day.
So we get credit even if we're not in spandex jumping all over the place. That's a good thought.
You know, a lot of us, myself included, we don't want to be in spandex, so
yeah,
I don't encourage that.
That's awesome. So everybody has risk factors that you need to kind of fold into your own little regimen. What would those be?
Right. So risk factors, we divide them into two groups. There are risk factors that we cannot control. So these are things like aging, family history of heart disease, male sex. And then there are risk factors that we can control. And that's really where the focus is for cardiologists and primary care physicians. These are the so-called modifiable risk factors. So modifiable risk factors are cigarette smoking, high blood pressure, diabetes, high cholesterol, inactivity, and stress.
It does seem to know some of those numbers, Dr. Bill, that you're going to have to see a doctor.
So the numbers that people will have available to them, the one obvious one would be blood pressure. If you are under age 60, the goal for your blood pressure is less than 140 on the top and less than 90 on the bottom. And when we check blood pressure, it should really be in a relaxed state. You should be sitting quietly for a few minutes. We want to know the blood pressure kind of when you're in a calm, relaxed environment. When you come to the doctor's office, you know, we kind of rush you into a room.
Yeah.
And tell you to take off your clothes, check your blood pressure at the same time. People are very nervous and tense, and so we get readings that tend to run a little bit higher. Those aren't the readings we want to treat. I like to tell people, we want to treat your home blood pressure readings when you're relaxed.
Yeah.
Now, the second part of that is if you're older than 60, recently in the last, within the last year, we've raised the blood pressure target for beginning medication. And so the new blood pressure goal, if you're over age 60, is 150 on the top and 90 on the bottom. And we did that because we thought we were really starting to over-medicate people, particularly older people, trying to drive that number down.
Yeah, you can't have a 20-something blood pressure when you're 65, right?
No, or 65, you know, maybe you can get away with it, but when you're 80 and you're on, you know, eight other medications to treat other things, then you really do start to get what we call polypharmacy, and these medications can interact, and we really want to only keep you on what you absolutely have to be on.
Absolutely. So what do we need to understand, like, about tests related to heart conditions?
Well, the one, I don't know that this is exactly a test, but just in following up on the risk factors, you know, we've talked about these isolated risk factors, but no one risk factor is really going to give you a great idea of what your risk is over the next 10 years. You have to consider all the risk factors. And now we have available to us some formulas that factor in all the different risk factors and spit out a likelihood of having a heart attack in the next 10 years. So these formulas, they're called risk formulas. They're readily available online. Your doctor's office can do them. They'll kind of plug in your age, sex, cholesterol, blood pressure, blood sugar, all these different numbers, and they'll spit out your risk. And if your risk is less than 10% of having a heart attack in the next 10 years based on this formula, that's considered low risk. If your risk is 10 to 20% of having a heart attack in the next 10 years, that's considered intermediate risk. And if your risk is greater than 20%, that's considered high risk. And so a lot of the treatment that we do is based on that risk. So low risk people get treated with less intensive medical therapy. Intermediate risk people, we treat more aggressively. So cholesterol targets and things change, and our threshold to use medication changes depending on your risk.
Cardiologist at Holland Hospital, Dr. Bill Frauenheim, talking about Heart Health Month. Obviously, we want to do things to prevent heart attacks.
Yeah, I think that kind of nails it on the head. You know, when we're dealing with heart attacks, prevention is the key.
Yeah.
Once you start having a heart attack, you know, then we kind of go into a different mode, but we really want to prevent that from happening in the first place.
Do you always know you're having a heart attack?
No. And that is a challenge. Symptoms of a heart attack can be very different in different people and can be very difficult to recognize. So the classic three symptoms that everybody should be aware of is a pressure or a tightness or a discomfort that is in the chest, but it can also be in the jaw, in the back, and go down the arms. It's not always a pain. You know, we talk about chest pain, and my patients tell me, you know, I didn't have any pain when I had my heart attack. All I had was a pressure in my chest or a tightness in my chest. So it really can be a very vague sensation. The second major symptom is shortness of breath. People get very winded. They just have a sense that something is not right. And the third symptom is indigestion, nausea, a little bit of sweatiness. And so these are very vague symptoms. And many times people confuse indigestion for heartburn. And yeah. So we frequently see heart attacks missed when people blame indigestion on their stomach.
Yeah, so many times you think, well, it's just, you know, just something I ate or whatever, and I wouldn't want to be wrong, you know, going into the hospital and find out I don't have a heart attack.
Right. Well, that's it. People are, you know, like anybody. It's human nature. You're embarrassed if you go in and, you know, I think I'm having a heart attack, and the doctor says, no, you know, it's just your stomach.
Yeah.
But I think the message is we in the emergency room and in the hospital, we like to give that message. We want to see people because if you have these symptoms and they persist for longer than 5 to 10 minutes, you know, then we say call 911 and get into the hospital as soon as you can. Just to let, you know, to clarify what we mean when we say heart attack, you know, that means that one of the blood vessels to the heart has closed. And so part of the heart muscle now is not getting blood supply. If the heart muscle does not get blood supply, it starts to die. And that cell death is irreversible. So you're going to live with that for the rest of your life. Now, it takes 20 or 30 minutes for that cell death to begin. And the longer the blood vessels closed, the more damage you will have. And if the blood vessel is never opened, then the entire portion of the heart that's served by that blood vessel is going to die. But if we open it, that heart attack is going to stop the second the blood vessel is opened. So the sooner we do it, the more heart muscle we save. That's why we say time equals muscle. The quicker it's open, the more heart muscle we save.
Are you supposed to take an aspirin right away if you think you're having some of this stuff?
Yeah, you know, an aspirin is a good thing to take because aspirin is a blood thinner, and it can help open the blockage that causes a heart attack.
Okay.
And I wouldn't want taking an aspirin to delay making a call or coming in.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you call 911 and you're sitting there waiting, wondering what you can do, then taking a full dose aspirin is a very good thing to do.
Doctor, how does a heart attack differ from congestive heart failure?
That is a very good question because they're two different things, and the word congestive heart failure, I think, means different things to different people. A heart attack is what I just explained. It's a blocked artery, so it's a plumbing problem. Congestive heart failure is, if we think of the heart as a pump that pumps blood, congestive heart failure is when fluid backs up behind the pump, and it's usually because the heart or the pump is weak. So a heart attack is a plumbing problem. Congestive heart failure is more of a pump problem. And congestive heart failure, if fluid backs up behind the heart, it's got to go somewhere. And so frequently where it goes is the lungs. And the lungs are like a big sponge. Normally, they're just filled with air. But when blood or fluid backs up behind the heart, that fluid starts to fill up the lungs. And so now, just like a sponge filled with fluid, the lungs are filled with fluid, and there's no room for air. So people get very short of breath, and that's the main symptom of what we call heart failure or congestive heart failure, shortness of breath.
Does someone suffer from that when they have pneumonia?
No, the symptoms can be similar because pneumonia is a lung infection and causes shortness of breath. But congestive heart failure is not an infection. It purely has to do with fluid backing up into the lungs because the heart is not pumping it forward well enough, so it's backing up. But heart failure, it does not mean the heart stops. It does not mean that you're going to die. In fact, heart failure, like pneumonia, can be treated. And if you get put on medications, and we get rid of the fluid from the lungs, then you no longer have heart failure. You just have a history of heart failure. So just like pneumonia can be treated, and you don't walk around with pneumonia for the rest of your life, heart failure can be treated, and you don't walk around with heart failure for the rest of your life.
While we're defining things, what is a heart murmur?
Well, a heart murmur is, first of all, very common. And a heart murmur, unlike these other things that we've talked about so far, a heart murmur can be completely normal. In fact, most of the time it is normal. A heart murmur is a sound heard with a stethoscope, and it's the sound of blood crossing a valve. So it can cross a normal valve and cause a normal heart murmur, or if a valve is sticking, that can cause a heart murmur. Sticking means the valve is not opening all the way. And in some cases, if a valve sticks, most of the time that does not cause a problem, but if that sticking gets to be severe, then it can get to the point where it has to be fixed with surgery, and that's something that we see typically in older people where their valves stick. It's kind of like arthritis of the valve. As you get older, it kind of sticks more and more, and in rare cases can ultimately need to be replaced.
My father-in-law is 94 and had heart surgery a year ago, last spring, and it was an amazing change for him. He had, I think, some kind of blockage, and he went from gray complexion to pink after surgery. It was amazing, and he did so well. You know, I mean, he got stronger and stronger. It took like 6 months, but it's amazing difference of what, you know, getting those valves to work right will do for you.
Well, it is, and it can be exactly that dramatic. You know, many of these valve problems can cause, decline and even death if they're not treated. But if treated, you're back to normal. So many of these valve issues are things that are completely curable. And so picking them up and making the correct diagnosis is one of the key things when you're dealing with the valve or other kinds of heart disease.
Sure. Now, stress management, you mentioned something about stress with being one of the risk factors with heart involvement. What would you say to that, doctor?
Well, stress is challenging for us as physicians because, for one thing, it's difficult to measure stress and put a number on it. So for that reason, I think the role of stress is underappreciated. You know, I think stress causes more harm than we recognize because we just can't measure it. It's not like cholesterol. You do a blood test, this is your stress level, and therefore it's easy to put two and two together. And so I think we just have to recognize that it is a risk factor and look for ways to decrease it. You know, I think there's healthy stress, and then there's kind of destructive stress. And healthy stress is the kind of stress that kind of energizes you, you know, and gets you going. Mm-hmm. And unhealthy stress is the kind that just kind of eats away at you. So the classic unhealthy stress would be the person, you know, sitting at a desk with endless tasks in front of him, feels completely buried and unable to cope with it, and that is a negative stress. In terms of dealing with it, healthy ways of dealing with stress, one would be exercise. You know, I think that's one of the best ways of dealing with stress. And then, you know, for different people, it's different things. You know, some people do yoga. Some people do transcendental meditation. Some people walk outside. Some people birdwatch. You know, it's whatever, you know, you like to do. I think there's a lot of healthy ways to deal with stress. And, of course, there's negative ways to deal with stress. Smoking, drinking, eating. So we want to just modify our behavior towards the healthy ways of dealing with it.
What about chocolate? Is chocolate good for stress?
Speaking of eating.
Chocolate is outstanding for everything. No.
I was hoping you'd say that.
Oh, live long and eat chocolate. Yeah, there you go.
You know, that is a good question because chocolate has been getting more and more attention lately. Dark chocolate has some antioxidant properties. And so, you know, when the cocoa content is, you know, towards 80%, you know, there's thought to be potentially some protective effects. But, you know, chocolate is also a source of a lot of calories and can contain saturated fats. So it's like many things. I think moderation is the key. And I think the people, you know, some of the people that are the healthiest with the best lifestyles, you know, they're not afraid to have what they enjoy every now and then.
Yeah.
So it's just moderation.
So love is good for the heart at Valentine's Day, right?
That is a great way to sum it up. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, we thank you so much, Doctor, for taking time today. And we just appreciate your ability to take those huge, long words and put it into concepts that we can easily understand. That's a real gift, sir. Thank you so much for taking time from Holland Hospital this morning to let us know about heart health.
Well, thanks very much. I enjoyed it.